right now at 1:30 and one at 2:30. We will take a recess between arguments. But at this point in time, let me introduce the panel. To my left, the rookie on the panel is Justice Brian Walker. To my right is Justice Mike Wallach, and I am Justice Wade Birdwell. And we will be hearing these two cases today, so I'll ask the clerk to go ahead and call this case, if you will, please.
The court will now call number 75343 CB, Zucker v. Segeer. May it please the court, Mr. Jeremy Martin will argue for appellant, Mr. Niles Billick will argue for appellee.
Counsel.
May it please the court, counsel. Last week, the Supreme Court of Texas handed down Volk versus Copper Creek. At the very beginning of the opinion, the Supreme Court reminds us that when courts of appeals are presented with an appeal with multiple issues, the Court of Appeals should address the issues that could result in rendition first. As a matter of judicial economy, as a matter of finality, let's deal with the rendition issues first. So I'd like to take the issues in that order this afternoon. The first rendition issue we have, I think, is easy. It's the $15,000 and change in attorney's fees that were the malicious prosecution attorney's fees damages. The appellee has conceded in their brief that they're not pursuing that anymore. The evidence was legally insufficient to support that. So that's a rendition of a take nothing. The second,
do they concede that, or do they simply say they're not going to contest it? In other words, you make the point that it's legally insufficient, but I seem to remember they just said they're not going to contest it. But whether that constitutes,
you know,
Honor, a concession or not, let me.
I may have overstated that. Apologies if I did.
I'm not
sorry
saying
if
you did.
I didn't make
I'm
the
just,
distinction.
Is there a distinction between we're not going to contest it and we concede that there's no evidence?
Yes, Your Honor. There is a difference.
Okay.
There. And so if I misspoke, I do apologize.
No problem.
But the bottom line is they are no longer contesting whether they are entitled to recover the $15,000 in attorney's fees for malicious prosecution. So that's our argument would be a rendition of take nothing on that.
Now, based on Bearden, we allowed that type of damages, but your contest was that there was no, it didn't meet the standards with regard to evidentiary review on the award of attorney's fees, or no roramos or anything of that nature.
That's right, Your Honor.
Okay.
The brief lays it out. They were going to try to seek them. They did not timely provide their attorney's fees evidence. We asked that it be stricken. The court sustained our objection. They said, well, maybe we don't need that evidence at all. We'll just say it. And of course, under roramos, you can't do that. And so that's what ended up happening. There is no roramos compliant evidence in this record to support that award of the malicious prosecution attorney's fees.
Okay. Is there a difference between attorney's fees that are needed with regard to that are subject to award based upon fees that are litigation fees? In other words, if I have a breach of contract cause of action and I prevail on that breach of contract cause of action, roramos clearly applies to that because I'm saying that this is what it cost me, and I'm entitled only to my reasonable attorney's fees under those circumstances. Whereas in the malicious prosecution, here's a statement that I'm injured to this amount. This is what I paid, and I shouldn't have had to pay that. Do we have a case one way or the other that indicates that roramos applies under the circumstances?
I cannot cite the court to a case, but in my practice, I have yet to see a case where the Supreme Court, since roramos, has blessed attorney's fees and affirmed them based on anything short of roramos compliant evidence.
Okay.
They just don't do it. The second rendition point that we would argue is the future mental anguish damages. The court has read the briefs. The court understands the arguments. There is no evidence. It's not a legal or factual sufficiency quibbling argument. There is literally no evidence that Dr. Segere will continue to suffer compensable mental anguish after the trial. None. The only evidence, in fact, is that she will not. She was clearly no longer undergoing any treatment. All of the medical records reflect that as of the dismissal of her case in January 2023, she's no longer struggling with any sort of anxiety, any sort of stress. She's excited about her new job. There's just no evidence in this record of future mental anguish. So what the appellees do is they point to two items. Number one, they say there's two words that Dr. Segere says, "I'm scared." And so the appellees say, well, there it is right there. That's evidence that she was scared as of the moment of trial. And by the way, I'm liberally construing the argument that there was evidence that she was scared at the time of trial. I think the court is familiar enough with the law on mental anguish damages that just that sort of statement is woefully insufficient to support any award of future mental, of any mental anguish damages. Certainly not $250,000 in future mental anguish damages. So the second argument that they make is, well, there was a reasonable probability, this is on page 56 of their appellee's brief, there was a reasonable probability that the malicious conduct will continue. Well, that's a totally separate issue. That's not what the jury was asked. The jury was asked for mental anguish as a result of the occurrence in question, which was the incident on April the 6th. That's what this whole case is about. The standard for the recovery of future mental anguish damages is not, do we think that the defendant's going to continue to do additional bad things, or as they say here, malicious conduct in the future. That's not the standard. The standard is there a reasonable probability that the plaintiff is going to continue to suffer mental anguish as a result of the occurrence that's already happened? You don't get to have the jury result in conjecture and speculation about what Dr. Zuffer may or may not do in the future. The law just doesn't allow that. That's not
address
that's
not the. Right. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Brian. Go ahead. Address the attempt to bring in the protective order cases, which indicate that a court can enjoin communication, enjoin contact based upon likely future injury without actually finding that that future harassment will occur. It's all based upon the past harassment. Has any court ever used that type of thing to say that we can assume future mental anguish based upon past misconduct?
Certainly not that I'm aware of, and I think that the court used the right word, enjoin. That's an injunction is what that is. Those protective orders in family violence cases are injunctions that are put there based on an entirely separate, specific to family law set of circumstances that you have to show in order to get a protective order.
Was there any testimony from Ms. Segere that she expected in the future that Dr. Zuffer would do anything in the future one way or the other?
The best they have is I'm scared.
Okay, so your basic argument is when there's talking about the jury could essentially assume that there would be future bad acts or future torts in the future and could award damages for future torts in the future. Even if that were true under the law, there's no evidence to support that.
That's right. And with the caveat of even if that were true under the law, which it isn't, but even if it were true under the law, there's no evidence that she ever said anything remotely like that.
Well, going back to just what did happen in this case, you know, I guess the question I have is, can a jury look at what took place and think to themselves, well, that was so bad that any person would have future mental anguish based on everything that's aggregated and everything that that person experienced? Now, you're telling us that there has to be some evidence in the record to support that there is ongoing mental anguish, that there will be mental anguish in the future, but why can't a jury look at the totality of the situation, everything that took place, and say, hey, any person in this situation could suffer or will be likely to suffer future mental anguish?
That we talked about that in our reply brief, yeah. Where we said that basically what the appellees are saying is this behavior, they call it malicious conduct. This malicious conduct was so over the top that mental anguish is a foregone conclusion. We don't even have to come up with any evidence of it. The jury could say, yeah, anybody would. That is not the law. The law requires nature, duration, and severity evidence. You have to show that. You can't. The jury is not allowed to speculate or imply from nothing.
But they are allowed to place a value on evidence that demonstrates nature, duration, and severity. So when Dr. Saguier talks about the experience of turning yourself in, being placed in jail, being strip searched, being required not to, she doesn't get any privacy with regard to any of that. And she testifies and she says that was a bad experience. Why is the jury not reasonably, why can not the jury reasonably infer both duration, severity, and nature from that testimony alone and apply a value to that?
Because you have to start with some sort of legally sufficient evidence to begin with.
Well, that's the question is, are you saying that Parkway requires that there be something more than simply a description of what happened and that it was a bad experience, that there has to be something like nightmares, or there has to be something like crying, or in some way, shape, or form, that has to be demonstrated, and the jury can't simply infer from that bad experience and how it's described mental anguish from that?
So that's right, and at this point we've moved past future mental anguish damages because
that's where we are, right? Because your brief has focused on cases where there are manifestations of mental anguish, okay, in the form of nightmares or something of that nature. And the question I have is the jury limited to manifestations in terms of being able to find damages, or can the jury listen to the circumstances of the tortious conduct itself and some of the consequences of the tortious conduct and infer reasonably that there were mental anguish damages associated with that?
I am unaware of a single case where that's ever been permitted. The jury in this case had nothing upon which to base $255,004. Nothing. There's no corroborating testimony. We know that. The closest thing is her husband's testimony saying, quote, she was functional with family and work. We have no evidence of interference.
Well, but again, my question is, let's say she's a stoic. Okay, and so she follows stoicism. Fate has deemed this; she'll take it. That fine. So she doesn't cry. She doesn't have nightmares, etc. All right. There's no manifestation, if you will. And so you think the Supreme Court will basically say then that's not compensable in terms of malicious prosecution, or even if the jury finds that there's intentional infliction of emotional distress, as long as there's no manifestation, there are no damages.
The line that is currently drawn is if it's something so horrible, for example, something happens to someone's deceased relative, someone tampers with a body or something like that. I mean, it has to be unbelievably severe in order for
St. Elizabeth's Hospital. Right.
That's right. And short of that, no, the Supreme Court, I think based on Durant versus Anderson, is going to require a plaintiff putting on evidence of trying to recover mental anguish damages. They're going to have to put on some evidence of how it affected them. I mean, that's the very standard for it. It has to interfere with some sort of daily activity. That's the whole point.
Why wouldn't being strip searched in a jail rise to that?
Because she did not put on the same evidence that Mr. LeClaire put on in Bearden versus LeClaire, which was it absolutely wrecked him. He called his pastor. The pastor testified with corroborating evidence. This man was utterly destroyed. He was suicidal. Things of that nature. Those are the sorts of things that a jury can take and a jury can put a value on.
You know, I mean, and I understand what you're saying. You're saying this is the status of the law, right? But just me speaking out loud, you know, as trial strategy, a lot of times is, hey, don't pour it on, you know, don't get too sappy, because you lose credibility, you know, and so some people just think that for them, you know, and so they're not going to be apt to get up on the stand and whine about how terrible everything is. And they'll just defer to the fact that, you know, some things speak for themselves. I mean, if you haven't done anything illegally and you have to get strip searched, it's a pretty humiliating experience.
Understood.
For anyone.
Understood. And that would be how you get a jury's answer to yes, were you maliciously prosecuted? Chohan, I understand plurality. The Supreme Court hasn't given us anything that we could really put our finger on. But Chohan's going to require you to put on some kind of evidence to show the jury what mental anguish that you suffered. If you're a stoic, but you can't just stop short and say, what happened was so horrible, I don't even need to tell you about it. That is not the law.
Let me ask you this. We are required to defer to the credibility determinations of the jury and of the court to the extent the court makes that determination. How are we to deal with the fact that, let's, for example, say that when she testifies that it was a quote-unquote bad experience, okay? The jury is able to see her demeanor when she says that. The jury can understand, maybe she has a look about her, which is a look that some of us would say would be crushed or something of that nature. That's not something that we're going to be able to see off of the paper, off of the record, but that's what the jury saw, potentially. How do we deal with that type of issue? Is that why the court only allows manifestation? Or basically, are we just cutting the credibility determination of the jury out of the equation?
You're not cutting the credibility determination out of the equation, but they have to say something. The witness has to put on some kind of testimony or some kind of evidence. Once that's happened, then the jury gets to judge the credibility of that. But the jury doesn't get to just watch the way someone behaves without them actually uttering the words. That's why we have a record. That's why we have an appellate record. The words, the evidence actually has to appear in the black and white lines. And once it's there, and to the extent there's a credibility determination to be made, the jury makes it and we defer to it.
You don't think that we can infer emotional distress from the type of activity that's described here?
Not without more. No, Your Honor, I do not. And again, what we're down to is past mental anguish. We're talking about here, not future.
No, understood.
And just very quickly, to the extent that the court is inclined to not render a take nothing on past, or whether there's a remitter or suggestion for remitter or remand, the bottom line is that the way the case has already exists is there's going to have to be a reassessment of punitive damages no matter what, because we've lost part of the compensatory damages. We should lose more of the compensatory damage on future mental anguish damages, and so we're going to have to reassess.
What if the cap's 200 regardless? Do we still have to go back and reassess?
Bentley versus Bunton says you can't just say, hey, just because it satisfies the statute, it's fine. You have to actually go back and do a whole analysis. Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
My time is up, and thank you for your time.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel?
May it please the court. My name is Niles Illick, and I represent the appellee, Dr. Sadaf Sagir. I think an important place for me to begin is to say that my client never wanted to be here in the first place. My client didn't want to sue. She didn't want to be a plaintiff. She had to sue in this case to defend herself against the abuse of the criminal justice system by Dr. Sagir, the abuse of the professional licensing system, and the abuse of the civil court system. Turning to counsel's arguments and his discussion with Justice Birdwell about issue 3 and the attorney's fees, that was a concession. It was not intended to be just not to address the issue. We conceded that issue.
Do you agree then that we have to kick the exemplary damages back regardless?
I do not.
And why?
I can't read my handwriting here, but the case says that, and I'll submit it to the court, but it becomes a factor in determining whether or not the exemplary damages are excessive when you reduce the compensatory damage. It is not an immediate factor. And this is a really good case to understand why that is. This is not really a case about compensatory damages, right? This is not a negligence case where somebody drove the wrong way and crashed into somebody and you have a certain set of medical bills and then you've got this really wild mental anguish that the two aren't in line. Here, we're just not going to have a whole lot of medical bills. I think the record supports the idea that she would have liked to have more therapy but ran out of money to do it. And so it just, we don't have letters of represent, I don't know what they call it, but letters where the doctor will get paid afterward. That's not in this case. That's not this case. So you don't have that. So what you end up with is the compensatory damages being an indicator, a factor that you look to, but it isn't determinative of the entire thing. It doesn't say if you reduce it by $15,000 for what is not a large number anyway, right? The compensatory damages are small. That's his ratio argument. But this is not a case about compensatory versus exemplaries, and it never should be because it's a different kind of case. Malicious prosecution is always going to be a different kind of case.
Now, back to that briefly. Okay. Exemplary damages were not submitted under Chapter 41. Okay, there's no finding of gross negligence. There's no finding of statutory malice. It was submitted purely on what is actual malice in terms of evil will, et cetera, okay? So how are we to make a determination of whether or not the damages were excessive in terms of exemplary damages when we don't have an actual finding underneath it under Chapter 41? That's not a point of error. We can't reverse it based upon that, okay? It's effectively tried by consent under the circumstances. My question is how do we review it as excessive when we have a mismatching of the underlying liability that is the basis for the damages awarded?
And I hear two questions there, Justice Birdwell, and if I you've always let me know if I don't get it quite right to you. But
sure.
I hear this as part of his issue number four, where he's talking about the relationship between question seven and the relationship between question nine, where question seven is really about IIED and malicious prosecution, and question nine is really just about malicious prosecution. And my answer to that question, and
I don't have a problem with that because okay. In his reply brief, he says the occurrence that's mentioned in the damages questions is the malicious prosecution.
Okay, so we don't have, all right, then I forgive me for misunderstanding. As far as your question goes, my answer would be simply this. It hasn't been raised on appeal. I don't think the court can reverse it. The inability to review it is certainly complicated, but I would put that on the appellant, that it was their job to bring that forward, and they didn't bring that forward. We don't have we don't have the job to bring that forward as the appellee, and it simply would be an advisory opinion that's not before the court.
Are you aware of any case law? I know I'm going to be looking at Bearden fairly closely, but are you aware of any case law, either with regard to intentional infliction of emotional distress, where emotional distress is part of the tort itself, and malicious prosecution, which seems to inherently anticipate emotional distress?
Right.
Okay. Is there any case law that basically says what you're arguing, which is the tort itself, a jury can reasonably infer from the tort itself mental anguish because it's baked into the tort?
I think we would have to look to the there's no case that I know of that just says that expressly. So what I think we would have to do,
I mean, we clearly in Bearden we went through the Parkway analysis.
Right. Right, but I think you could look to I don't have a case on that, but I think that it is inherent in these kinds of cases that you're not going to end up with these compensatory damages. It's all about these sort of emotional damages, and I don't know.
Well, malicious prosecution is an old tort, okay? It goes back a way back, okay?
I didn't know that.
Well, it does. And so the question becomes, before the state of Texas started looking to allow the award of mental anguish, okay, before Sanchez versus Schindler, et cetera, that type of thing, and even back before turn of the last century, have you looked at all with regard to how that tort was compensated for with regard to the case law?
Justice Birdwell, I hold
and that's my happy place. The 19th century is my happy
place. Sure, I hold a PhD in 19th century German history.
Yes.
So I love the assignment, but the truth is that I haven't gone into it, okay. And because it's often a personal indulgence when I do that. But I'm happy to do that and submit a brief to the court on that and to counsel. But I would like to turn to the question I think that you all had really with opposing counsel, and that is this evidence of future mental anguish. And I think that there are a couple of important points here that should be made, and we'll start with the simplest ones. There was testimony from my client at trial that this whole event of all the attacks on her, the medical board, the criminal, the civil, required her to spend all of her money, and in fact to borrow from friends. And at the end of trial, that at the time of trial, that had not been paid off. That debt remained existing. And I don't think anyone in this courtroom has had the unfortunate experience of running out of money and having to borrow from friends, but I don't think it's that hard to infer from that future mental anguish will occur. It's hard to go see your friend and have dinner when you owe that friend money. It's hard to invite that friend to a concert when you owe that friend money. It's hard when you are the breadwinner of the family to be out of money. And that's where, in fact, my client was.
These are reasonable inferences. Obviously, your opposing counsel is going to say that there has to be some evidence of this, but why do you not? I mean, that's respond to why you think that. I mean, these are reasonable inferences.
That's exactly it, Justice Walker. These are absolutely reasonable inferences that a reasonable jury could look at and say, most people have been tied on money at some point in their life. That's not an unusual experience. They can understand what it would be like to be out of money, to have to borrow money from friends. They know what that means. To have not paid that money back, they know what that means. Jurors understand that.
Most jurors probably haven't been strip searched in jail.
No, one would hope not.
But that gets us back to the question of to what extent does our law allow jurors to reasonably infer mental anguish when there is little or no testimony concerning the manifestation of that mental anguish? Even in the old days, well before Schindler, Sanchez versus Schindler, there used to be a physical injury requirement for the courts to allow mental anguish damages in tort cases. You had to have a physical manifestation in order for that to occur. And in Sanchez, the court said, we're not going to require that anymore because you've lost a loved one. We're going to assume that, which is very similar to St. Elizabeth's versus Girard with regard to the abuse of a dead body.
Right.
So it seems like you need to try and figure out how to get malicious prosecution closer to the dead body abuse and further away from the personal injury.
There are two answers to that, Justice Birdwell. And the first one is, I do think we have evidence of manifestation. She testified that she couldn't sleep even the night before the trial. That is a manifestation of the emotional distress. The night before coming to trial, she's still having trouble sleeping. The jury can reasonably look at that and say, just because trial's over doesn't mean that will end. That the money factor that we discussed earlier, she still owes the money, she still has. These are problems that are going to continue moving forward, from this. And I think that you can look at this, you have to look at this, from the deferential standard that you referred to earlier on the standard of review for either factual or legal sufficiency. You have to look at these things depending on which one you're doing, but in the light most favorable to the prevailing party. And when you do that, I think you see manifestations. Now, is this case more similar to the
death? The reason, though, I think the court wants some degree of manifestation, and we'll look at see what the manifestation is because we're not supposed to sit as a jury okay?
Right.
And so to the extent that we allow reasonable inferences from the jury based solely upon the conduct itself, that really gets us very close to doing the exact same thing up here, making reasonable inferences and almost sitting as a jury, which we're not supposed to do.
Well, look at page look at page 20 of volume 4 of the record. She is going to tell you at page 20 that even the night before trial, she's still having difficulty sleeping. She's still having problems. That is a manifestation. If you look at page 13 and page 34, you're going to see the problems that come in volume 4, the problems that come with being a debtor to your friends, that come with being without money. Now, I think this case is far closer to the dead body case than it is to the, say, PI car accident case. And I think it's clear because anyone who looks at this and sees what my client went through, when you view it through the eyes of the jury, what the jury found, right? The jury found a staged attack. They found a false report to the police. They found a medical board report that wasn't sustained. And then they found that the appellant was just completely wrong and made up the civil suit. When you look at this, that is much more like the outrage of the dead body than it is like a PI case. I mean, it just is. Like, the PI case is the difficulty of, you know, I can't take my wife out to dinner because my back is hurting, and that's that. But this is something entirely different. This is something that is so outrageous that I think anyone would look at it and say, of course there's mental anguish here.
It's almost a social tort.
Okay.
Let's separate out past. And the jury gave the exact same amount of money, past and future, in terms of mental anguish. And let's assume that we can infer mental anguish from all those things that occurred in the past. How does that get us to that same amount in the future when all you're talking about, and I don't mean to minimize it, but it's one thing to go through arrest processing, strip search, have your career challenged, your license challenged, all those types of issues, and then at trial I can't sleep, and then taking that into the same amount of damages in the future. How do you connect that in terms of what's the connection between that amount of future damages for mental anguish versus what was experienced in the past?
And I hear two questions there, Justice Wallach, and if I don't answer your question, let me know.
Glad you can hear it because I'm having a hard time saying it.
I hear you loud and clear. So there are two parts to that, in my opinion. One is that we will never know what went on in that jury room. We are not going to know what happened back there. So this idea that they're two different, that the two numbers are the same or that it adds up to $1 million, the judge instructed the jury to deliberate carefully, right? We assume that the jury followed the judge's instructions. And so I think we have to assume that they deliberated carefully and for whatever reason came up with the right numbers. Now, I think it's fairly easy to substantiate the first number, the one for the past. It gets a little harder to substantiate the one for the future. And the question I hear from you is, how do I substantiate that number when all that in the past comes up to the same number?
By its very nature, we don't know how this is going to manifest in the future because it's in the future.
Exactly.
So the jury's being asked, as a matter of proximate cause and probability, to award damages for a manifestation that they expect will likely occur in the future. So if in fact the only testimony we have is that I'm scared, okay, and all of the things that justify the past in terms of strip searching, et cetera, there may be something that, you know, is an indelible mark psychologically, if you will. But to what extent, if there's, you know, if all the things that are causing the manifestation are over with and there's some evidence that those matters are being resolved psychologically, to what extent can a jury start inferring over into the future and then to the exact same amount as all the bad stuff that has happened in the past.
And Justice Birdwell, Justice Wallach, this is the hard part, right? We will never know what happened in that jury room, and we afford that jury tremendous discretion in doing that. Now, that discretion is not unlimited, of course, and it has to be grounded in law. We know that from evidence. We know that from Gregory versus Chohan and everything else. But I think that when you look at what has happened here, you look at what happened, the jury heard from my client. They watched her on the stand. They listened to her testify. They heard her say, I'm out of money. I owe people money. They heard her say, I am still not sleeping. They heard her talk about her mugshot being everywhere and the fact that she gets her business, she's a gastroenterologist, she gets her business by being referred from primary care physicians, that people don't want to refer to her because this is out there. That causes an internal concern that the jury can look to that is separate and apart from what happened in the beginning. The jury heard these things. The jury, it doesn't even take...
So you're essentially saying the jury can reasonably infer that she's still going to continue to worry about loss of inability to obtain clients into the future based upon what's happened in the past.
The ongoing consequences of what's happened in the past.
That's still the tort itself without necessarily any manifestation.
What goes on the internet stays on the internet generally. So when her mugshot is out there for the world to see, and that's what the jury heard, right? The jury heard this. The mugshot is out there for the world to see, and the primary care physicians don't want to refer to me anymore. And by the way, I've spent all my money and I owe all my friends money. That is significant mental anguish in the future. My job has gone down. My ability to do my job has gone down. My reputation has suffered. It will continue to suffer. I'm rebuilding. I'm working to get there. I'm not there yet. These are products of the malicious prosecution that will continue into the future. And I think they're there. I think that they are there. And they are separate and different, though very much related to what happened at the beginning. And so, Justice Wallach, this has been a very long answer to what I think was a straightforward question. What are the damages for the future versus the past?
With certain interference.
And does it matter that they're the same number? And my answer is that we owe enormous deference to the jury. I don't think anyone's going to dispute that. There's no way to mathematically calculate this. We are not ever going to know why they came up with the same number. The number in the past is justified by all the things we've talked about, but the number for the future is also justified. And
So what was the time between the time of the events and the time of trial?
It was about 2 years.
And how old was she at the time of trial, and what is her life expectancy?
Your Honor, I don't know her age, but she's...
No, just in the record.
Yeah, it's in the medical records. I don't know her age, but she's a medical doctor. She must be in her 50s, treats herself, takes care of herself, must have a life expectancy into the 80s. 30 years.
Couldn't you say that the fact that they did assign the future the same as the past, that actually bolsters your argument that they can make these inferences, that the jury can say, hey, we think she's going to suffer in the future just as much as she suffered in the past, and then it bolsters the fact that you're saying we think it's going to be in like kind.
Yes, and Justice Walker, I'm out of time if I may comment on that.
Sure.
Answer, and that'll be enough.
I think that's exactly right, and they can say they saw her, they heard her, they know that she's out. I've been over these things. They know she's out of money. They know she borrowed money. They know her mugshot's all over the internet. They know people don't want to refer to her anymore. These are things that cause future mental anguish. It's there. It's in the record. You'll see it. I thank the court for the opportunity to be here this afternoon and the chance to argue. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Go ahead and add a minute to counsel's reply.
Thank you.
Rebuttal.
May it please the court. I think we're the court to hold that under the circumstances of this case, a jury could reasonably infer, even though there was no evidence, that that the plaintiff would suffer compensable mental anguish. either in the past or in the future. I think what the court would be doing would be creating categories of cases that would automatically entitle a prevailing plaintiff to that measure of damages.
Well, an intentional infliction of emotional distress is a category of case that literally has emotional distress baked into it. And I think my use of the term social tort really adequately describes an abuse of a dead body type of situation, you know, type of thing. So again, how you're arguing we should be treating this like the old physical manifestation argument, except you don't have to have physical manifestation, but you do have to have some manifestation, okay, type of thing, and we should be over there as opposed to, no, the jury should be able to compensate for something that is socially unacceptable type of thing.
And how do you respond to the fact that Mr. Illick essentially says that there is some manifestation? I know you addressed a little bit at the beginning. You said the piece about the fact that she said she's scared. But he actually brought up some things that are in the record that go, I'd say, that are more than just that I'm scared statement.
And those are the financial concerns. Those are the reputational damages, maybe lost future profits. None of that was submitted as elements to the jury. They could have been, but they didn't submit those.
But they're in the record. They were in testimony before the jury, correct?
Well, that raises this question, okay? In order for the jury to your argument, it sounds like, is in order for the jury to consider the fact that there may be financial difficulties associated with this occurrence going forward into the future that she's quote unquote scared about, such as, you know, job security, such as my mugshots on the internet forever type of thing, that has to be submitted separately from mental anguish, and that's not something that can be considered with regard to the mental anguish situation. It kind of already was with regard to pulling the legal fees out, okay? That was something, but it sounds like the jury got to consider those anyway a little bit in terms of how much money she said she spent and debt she went into.
That's right, and I think the way that the law works is, even if you take, for example, what the court is proposing, that a jury could reasonably infer from just the actions themselves that there's some mental anguish, the law draws a very hard line between compensatory mental anguish and non-compensatory mental anguish. If you want to be compensated for the mental anguish, you have to satisfy the law that requires nature, severity, and duration evidence. So it's fine if the jury wants to say, yes, of course, there was mental anguish there. But the jury can't decide that it's compensable without meeting the legal standards that have been very clear for a very long time, this nature, severity, and duration. And we're ignoring the amount. There has to be some basis for the amount.
So the mere testimony that I was embarrassed and having be strip searched, you would suggest, because it's just mere embarrassment, is not compensable.
That's right.
So therefore, there had to be something more than mere embarrassment being strip searched. It had to be manifested in some other way, and that evidence wasn't forthcoming.
And I don't know why they didn't try to put that on. I don't know what they just sort of stopped. They just sort of said, look at that, jury, now come up with some numbers, which of course the court, I don't have to tell you, $1 million backed into both past and future exactly the same. All kinds of issues, the round numbers, the same awards, the damages awards are a huge red flag in this case for appellate review. The point I want to make, though, on the manifestations, I can't help but look at what you had in Bearden, for example. You had $210,000 in pecuniary and reputational harm, and that was based in part on evidence of $300,000 in lost gross profits that was in the record. And you had a $485,000 past mental anguish award, so it was basically 2.5x of that $210,000 number. And in that case, you had dry heaving, involuntary muscle twitches, diarrhea, corroborating pastor who says he visited with him several times a week regarding his depression and suicidal tendencies, suicidal thoughts. He was isolated. He was reclusive. He had an ugly divorce that was not nearly as traumatic as his malicious prosecution. And again, in Bearden, I think it's important to point out, Mr. LeClaire was being accused of horse theft, which went to the heart of his profession. That's what he did.
I mean, this is Texas, right?
Yes, sir. Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. You can't. A horse thief? Get out of here. And so in order to reach those kinds of numbers.
He's about to say get a rope. You know that, right?
I don't know if we can do that anymore.
The Picante commercial is coming
to mind. It's not that far in the past. And even in Durant, you had this demeanor change, and you had interfamilial relationships being affected. You have none of that here. You have the opposite. You have evidence that interfamilial relationships were not impaired. And last thing I'll say about the sleep, if the court looks at, he cited the fourth volume, page 20, liberally construing that testimony, there are two nights where she didn't get much sleep. The night after the incident, before her visit with Dr. Malhotra, and then the night before she testified. That's it. That's all that evidence shows. And so I'm sorry and thank you for the additional time, and I appreciate your opportunity to talk to you today. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The matter is submitted. We appreciate the arguments of counsel and very helpful. And we will stand adjourned, recessed for the second argument here in